Matthew 22, I'll begin reading verse 15 and read down to verse 22, and then we'll reference these verses a couple different times, as well as some other verses. Matthew 22, verse number 15. Then went the Pharisees and took counsel how they might entangle him, him being Jesus, in his talk. And they went out unto them, and they sent out unto him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, now notice the deceptiveness of what they're saying. Master, we know that thou art true, and teachest the way of God in truth. They don't really mean this, because you know from verse 15, they're just, it's just political doublespeak for them. And teachest the way of God in truth. Neither carest thou for any man, for thou regardest not the person of men. Tell us therefore, what thinkest thou? Now here's the trip that they're hoping to, the trick they're hoping to trip them up in. Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, why tempt ye me, ye hypocrites? Show me the tribute money. And they brought him to him a penny. And he saith unto them, whose is this image and superscription? They saying to him, Caesar's. Then saith he unto them, render. Now the word render means pay. It's several times in the Bible it talks about paying all that you owe. That's what it means. Render, pay, give what is due. That's the idea. Render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God, or in context, render unto God, that's what it means, and unto God the things that are God's. When they heard these words, they marveled and left him and went their way. Now we've looked at these. This is the last of the eight we call Baptist distinctives. Now let me clarify. I've said this several times. Let me clarify. These are not Baptist teachings. These are biblical teachings that the Baptists, maybe the only group, have held to throughout the ages. Now, maybe some of these other groups have held on to, but the Baptists have historically been known for these eight specific biblical teachings. These would not be true in the Catholic Church or a Congregational Church or a Presbyterian Church or a Methodist Church or a Lutheran Church, Episcopalian Church, Methodist, I said that maybe, Wesleyan. Those, they may believe one or two or maybe a few of these, but these eight specific biblical teachings the Baptists have held on to, so we call them Baptist distinctive. They are distinctive to Baptist churches throughout the years, throughout the ages. Now, we looked at all, we're not going to review them. We looked at them, we talked about them in different contexts, because I'm going to spend all the time I got on this one. Now, in our text, Jesus makes several things, three things specifically clear that I want to share with you. We'll use this as a launch pad. He makes three specific things clear. The first thing he's telling us is we have a responsibility both to the state, that's Caesar, and to the Lord. Notice what he says in verse number 21. Then saith he unto them, render, pay, give, reward, whatever you owe there. That's the idea. Render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. So we have a responsibility both to the state and to the Lord. Now, we also know this if you go down to verse 37 of the same chapter. Jesus said unto him, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. If there ever is a conflict between Caesar and God, who should we render to first? God. Okay? So these are not equal. Okay? It's not like they're equal here. But he's saying is that there is a... there is a rendering to God, or to Caesar. Let's put Caesar on this side. Rendering to Caesar, and a rendering unto God. The second thing he's telling us in this text is this, that because I'm rendering to both, that means, number two, God implies that there is a separation of the things of the state and the things of God. If I'm rendering things then to Caesar, and there's other things I'm rendering to God, then there is, by necessity, by implication of that, there then is a separation of that. There is a separation. There are things that are under the control of Caesar. There are things that are under the control of the Lord. Now, I understand the Lord's in charge of all things. But the Lord has ordained certain things under the control of Caesar. For example, you go down the highway, and the speed limit says 55. And whether or not in a rental car, doesn't matter. How fast should you be going? 55. Okay. Why? Because you're rendering unto Caesar. Now I'm teasing Brother Becker. But you understand what I mean. There are rules. If the state comes in and says, well, you've got to have a fire extinguisher here, or you've got to have a fire alarm here, you can't say, well, this is a church and we're only under God's authority. But when it comes to certain codes like that, there are responsibilities we have to Caesar. And so we got to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar. We render to God, so there is a separation. So God implies that there's a separation. Now, the third thing I want you to notice, go down with me to verse 20. Because 1 and 2, most of us grasp, we've heard, we've thought about, we've considered, we probably gleaned ourselves. But the third one is the one that's important that sometimes we don't grasp. Look at verse 20. And he saith unto them, whose is this image and superscription? How is ownership going to be told? By what it looks like. That brings us to number 3. Ownership and image are connected. You will conform to that which controls you. This is why separation of church is important. Whoever has the final say. I'll give you an example. Charlemagne was king. Hadrian the First was the pope. Hadrian the First died, and Leo the something another, I forget, became the pope. Now, there was a division between the Franks and the Lombards, which are the lower Germany. This is all just neither here nor there, but this is just the background. Hadrian had went with the Lombards. Leo is going with the Franks, the other group of people. Well, the people who liked Hadrian now don't like Leo, and so Leo's bebopping down the street in Rome. They take him and they just beat him severely, leave him laying there. That's not enough. They come back, drag him to the church, and beat him some more. Well, Leo realized real fast, I need someone to help me. So Leo contacts Charlemagne. Charlemagne shows up and says, I'm going to, settle this. And so Charlemagne sides with Leo. Yeah, Leo, you're the Pope, you're the right guy. But Leo is a very shrewd, very slick person. Now, this is how it's said. I'm sure there's pre-planning to this. As Charlemagne was coming in the church to pray, Leo comes behind him and puts a crown on him and announces him as not just king, but as emperor. Now, why is that important? Because only a greater power can anoint the lesser power. And so by Leo saying, no, you're not just king, now you're the emperor, he was saying now that I have control over you. And you now need to conform to what I'm saying. And from that point forward, the Pope had a lot of control over the state. All it means is this, is that ownership and image are connected. You will conform to that which controls you. If the state is over the church, then the church is going to have to conform to the state. Now, the same thing is true in church is the same thing is true in even our own personal life. By that which controls us is that which we conform to. If you see someone and they're listening to worldly music, they're dressing worldly, they're talking worldly, they just have a worldly mindset, who are they? Who owns them? The world. Now, they may be saved, but you can tell that they're being controlled by the world because ownership and image are connected. You will conform to that which controls you. Now, that's what Jesus is teaching here. So he says, therefore, there needs to be this separation, this division. Not this union, but this division between church and state. Now, let's go to Romans 13. We're going to take a moment, and we're going to look at the different purposes of the state and of a local church. Romans 13, if you will. Look at verse 1. The first thing you'll notice, and I'll show you the slide here in a second, verse 1 says, let every soul be subject. Civil government is ordained by God for specific purposes. And that's what we're going to look at here starting in verse 1. Let every soul be subject to the higher powers, for there is no power, no authority, that's the idea, but of God. The powers, the authorities that be, are ordained of God, set up by God, allowed by God. Doesn't mean that every person who holds that position is God's will, but it means the positions are God's will. I cannot tell you that Barack Obama is the will of God to be the president. I can't tell you that George W. Bush was. But I can tell you this, there is a will of God that there is a president. That the position is in the will of God. Now I think the Lord sets up one and puts on another, and I think the Lord allows certain people to hold certain offices, sometimes as a blessing, sometimes as a curse. But the positions, regardless of the person who holds that position, the position is ordained of the Lord. Authority. Okay, so the powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, the authority, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Will thou then not be afraid of the power, the authority? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is a minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. In other words, if you're flying down the road 80 miles an hour and all of a sudden you see a policeman, you ought to be worried. If you're doing 55 and the speed limit is 55, then you ought to be able to just wave him as you go by. Shouldn't be worried. Okay? For some reason we keep talking about speed. I don't know why. Wherefore, you must needs be subject, only for wrath, but also for conscience sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. So that brings us to a couple of thoughts here. Okay? Almost already hit it. We have responsibility. Civil government is ordained by God for specific purposes. Okay? The Lord has set up civil authority. That's the president, Congress, courts, mayors, governors, legislatures, all those things for specific purposes. Doesn't mean they always do what they should do. Doesn't mean they're always right. But it means that there is the will of God is not for anarchy. The Lord isn't in for let everyone do that which is right in his own eyes. In fact, that phrase is mentioned in the Bible, but not in a good sense. Okay, always in a bad sense. So the Lord has ordained or set up civil government for specific purposes. Number two, Christians have a responsibility. Okay, good Christians ought to be good citizens. We ought to vote. We ought to know what the topics are. We ought to make our voice heard. We ought to try to influence our society, in moral ways, well. Now, there's more to that we should do than that, but at least that much. Number three, we are to obey their laws unless they conflict with God's laws. So, well, some of their laws aren't fair. Yeah, you're right. Some of them aren't. I don't agree with them. Well, that's okay. But unless you have a biblical principle to say I shouldn't do it. For example, King of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar said, don't pray. What did Daniel do? Pray. Why? Because he had a higher law. John the Baptist was put in prison. Remember the story where Jesus got his disciples together and raided that prison at night? And he didn't do it, did he? No. Doesn't mean that he was in there rightfully. But it means that there you have to look and say, okay, what is the biblical principles that are supposed to govern this situation? Okay, then the fourth thing is this. And this is one we don't necessarily like. We are to pay taxes and show respect to those in government. Regardless of who you vote for, whether you voted for Mr. Bush or you voted for Mr. Obama, he's still our president. We should be careful how we speak about him. Regardless of how you slant politically, we ought to be thoughtful. We ought to pay our taxes. I think every penny you owe, you ought to pay. I think you ought to work real hard, make sure you don't pay any more than you ought to pay. People say, well, I'm not paying, my tax money is going in to support things I don't agree with. Yeah. But there's a lot of things you do agree with. Don't you agree? You agree with the military? Yeah. You agree with certain, you agree with certain other things that we do? Now, there's a lot of money wasted. I mean, you cannot be spending, what's the budget now, $3 trillion or something? I mean, we spend unbelievable money wasted. I understand that. Okay, but it's the right thing to pay taxes. We shouldn't pay a penny more than you have to. And if they're willing to give you money, if it's legal, then take the money. But don't ever be one of these people saying, well, as a Christian, I shouldn't have to pay taxes. I'm under the Lord. No. The Bible says that we ought to pay tribute to whom tribute is due. Number five, we are to pray for those in authority in government. Now let's go to this verse. 1 Timothy, if you will. 1 Timothy chapter 3. Sorry, chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2. I'm at verse 1. I exhort therefore that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men. Now he's going to be a little more specific. For kings, that would be leaders. Okay, back in those days, mostly that's all they had was kings, but we have presidents and prime ministers and premiers, governors, whatever. Say, for kings and for all that are in authority. Now notice what we're praying for. We're not praying that the economy turns around. We're not praying that we have more jobs. We're not praying that we have greater technology. But here's specifically what we're praying for. That we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who have all men to be saved and to come into the knowledge of the truth. So we are to specifically pray that the government will not hinder our efforts for God. Mainly we're praying for freedom. Freedom is more important than the economy. It's better to have more freedom and the economy to tank. Because freedom allows us to preach the gospel. And we sometimes say, well, who's going to take care of me if the economy tanks? God. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things we add unto you. And so we are specifically praying that government will not hinder our efforts for the Lord. That's specifically what we're praying about. There's a lot of things you could mention. There's a lot of things that probably could use prayer, but specifically praying. And that would include this idea of separation. We don't want the government to harass us. We don't want to control it. We want it to do its job and let us do what the Lord has us to do. So what then is the purpose then of a local church? That brings us to Matthew 28. Matthew 28. Look at verse 19 and 20. Should be famous. Familiar verses for you. They're famous. It should be familiar to you. Matthew 28, look at verse 19. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Ghost, teaching them. Them would be the ones we've the original teaches the idea of witnessing. The ones we witness to, the ones we baptize, these people, this is discipling now in verse 20, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you, and lo, I'm with you always, even unto the end of the world. So we have three parts then. So we have the civil government has its responsibilities, and we looked at our responsibility to the civil government. So we're rendering unto them certain things. Now we render unto God, we think about the church, a church. A church is to encourage its members to faithfully spread the gospel. So I believe it's the responsibility of every Christian to be a soul winner, to be a witness for Christ. And a church is supposed to encourage that, organize, encourage people going out and doing that. Number two, a church is to baptize and train the converts. And then number three, our influence. Let me show you this verse before I jump into it. You're in Matthew, right? Go to Matthew 5. Now, 1 Timothy 3 tells us that the church is the pillar and ground of truth. So we're supposed to be holding to this truth, and we've talked about that at other times. But look at Matthew 5 with me. It's important to understand what our focus here is. We're not trying to moralize our society. Moralize, I mean, we're not trying to make it necessary, just make a nation more moral. Look at verse 14 of 5. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light to all that are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may become conservative Republicans. It didn't say that, does it? That they may see your good works and, what's the next word? Glorify your Father which is in heaven. So this is important to understand, number three. Our influence is for the sake of a gospel witness, not for a moral society. We as a church, as a group, as a body, we're not trying to go out into the world and make the world better. We're trying to win people to Christ. That's our goal. It may not change our government. It may not change Hollywood. It may not change the New York Times. But if we can win some, that's what we're supposed to be doing. New York Times is liberal. It's been liberal before you were born. It'll be liberal after, if the Lord tarries, after you're dead. We can whine and complain. If you don't, New York Times is basically the basis of the news of our nation. I don't know if you knew that or not. Everything goes back to the New York Times. What they say, here's what they used to say, is not news unless we say it's news. That was their old motto. News unless we say it's news. ABC, CBS, NBC, they're all liberal. They're always going to be liberal. Walter Cronkite was a liberal. Dan Rather was a liberal. Katie Kirk is a liberal. Whoever is on ABC now, Diane Sawyer, I think it is. Whoever is on NBC, I forget now who's on Brokaw, whoever. No, Brokaw's retired. Whoever the guy is. Now, we can whine and complain. They're always going to be liberal. But we can win people to Christ. And that's what we're here for. We're not here just to make a good, moral nation. We're here to see people saved. Now, that's what we're... So, if we're... And here's what I'm saying. Sometimes we look at Caesar saying, we got to clean Caesar up. We got to give Caesar a good bath. We got to make Caesar better. And God says, no, you render unto me. And you enter me by being a gospel witness. It may not change our society, but it's going to make an impact on the people we see saved. It'll make an eternal impact on them. Okay? So our influence is for the sake of a gospel witness, not now. Hopefully, if we do this right, it will change society, because society is made up of people, and if we get more saved people who are living for the Lord, it would change society. In theory, but that's not always... I mean, Rome was bad. Paul was a great apostle. Rome was still bad. In fact, Rome cut his head off. So our goal is not simply to make a good moral society. Our goal is to see people saved. Now, we're going to shift gears here. And we're going to kind of get into the idea of whole idea of separation of church and state. So you're going to do some writing, and I'm going to try to do some explaining. As I said, as we started out, because English is the way it is, sometimes we don't understand the meaning of words. So we're going to try to be real careful and define words and explain things so we understand what this idea of separation of church and state. Now, there are four schools of thought when it comes to church state separation. The first school of thought is this: the state, I'm a government above the church. State above the church. That means a secular government that is hostile to religion. Can you think of a situation, not as much now as common, but maybe several years ago, very common, a state above the church? Communists, right? The communists were this way. The state above the church. And it's still true in China and other places. So, and there's other countries, even not communists, are this way. But the state above the church, a secular government that is hostile to religion. Now, this is probably the contemporary meaning of separation of church and state that we fight against. Because what they mean when they say separation of church and state is really the state dictating to the church what it can do, when it can do it, where it can do it, and that's what we fight. We say, no, there's no idea of this church-state separation. That's what we're fighting against. Okay? So they have defined the separation of church and state as a separation of God in the state or a separation of religion in the state, and that's not what it means. But that's how they defined it, and it's become a very secular government hostile to religion. That's the first school of thought. The second school of thought when it comes to church-state separation is the church above the state. That would be a theocracy in which religion controls the government. On paper, that sounds good. That's really bad. That's almost as bad as number one, if not worse. The reason is both end up becoming corrupt. That's what usually what happens. The state becomes a corrupting influence on the religion. And then the religion, because it's becoming more corrupt, becomes even a corrupting influence on society, thus the government. And it's like the blind leading the blind. They both fall into the ditch. And so if you want to understand this, study Middle Ages with the Catholic Church. It was a church above the state. The end result was total heresy, darkness, a lack of gospel witness. The church, the Roman Catholic Church in 500 AD, when it started controlling, it had issues, but it was a whole lot better than 1,000 years later, 1500 AD, at the end of the Dark Ages. It was very, very corrupt by that time. Okay, so a church above the state is a very corrupting thing. They both end up corrupting each other. Then there's a third one. Now, the next two are very similar, but one is good and one is bad. Number three, church alongside the state. Now, let me just give you this as a background. This would be colonial America prior to the Revolutionary War. When the Puritans and the Pilgrims came to America, they didn't come for this reason. They came for this reason. They didn't mind the state controlling them or them controlling the state as long as it was their religion. The issue they had is because they couldn't have their religion and the state was persecuting them. They wanted to go somewhere where they could have their religion. They didn't want anyone else necessarily have their religion, but they wanted their religion. So church alongside the state. Now, this was a condition of many of the colonies. And it's also the, if you will, the preliminary to number one or two. It starts with number three, church alongside the state. But it doesn't stay that way. I read an article today. It's kind of interesting. You think of Microsoft, you think of Apple, and there's another company. I can't think of it. Both of them started with two leaders, Apple started with Steve Jobs and Wozniak. I forget his first name. Microsoft began with Bill Gates and Paul Allen. But it came to a point for those companies to go forward, someone had to get jettisoned. Wozniak got jettisoned out of Apple. Paul Allen got jettisoned out of Microsoft. Because you can't have a kingdom divided against itself will not stand. And so it starts with number three, but eventually one or the other has to take control. And so this sounds real good, but it never stays there. That's not the biblical way, and that's only preliminary to either the church above the state or the state above the church. Number four, historically, is where we've stood. A church separate from the state. That means a secular government that neither, now this is important, it neither favors nor hinders any particular religion. We're going to see this later somewhere in some point. But let me back up and say this. When we use the word religion, we're talking about Christianity. We're not talking about Buddhism, Hinduism, Muslim, or any other religion. The origin that our founding fathers, when they talked about religion, they meant, here's religion to them. There's the Baptist religion, there's the Catholic religion, there is the Congregational religion, there is the Anglican religion, there is the whatever other. There's always a Christian religion. To them, what they meant is denomination. That's the word we'd use today. So they would say then you can't have a particular denomination. Okay, it was never, and I'm not saying we ought to get rid of all the Muslims out of America or all the Buddhists or Hindus, but just historically it meant Christian religion. Okay, so you had a church separate from the state. That was what we've stood for. So it neither favors nor hinders. We don't want the government to say everyone be a Baptist, but we don't want them to say no one can be a Baptist. We just don't bother us. That was the idea. Leave us alone. So this is the historical Baptist position based on biblical beliefs. Now let's try this together. Go back to the front page of your notes, what has the eight things. I want you to look at those briefly. Which of these things, and we could probably use any one of them, and there's no necessary wrong answer, but I think a couple of them really should speak to us, really should jump out. Which of these would mean, if we really believe this, that we'd have to have a separation of church and state? How about the autonomy of the local church? If we really believe, A, autonomy of the local church, could we have this state above the church? No. Could we have church above the state? No. Can we have church alongside the state? No. If we really believe that every church is a local church governed by itself, then it would necessitate that we believe in a separation then of Caesar and God or church and state. Okay, how about, let me think of another one. How about individual soul liberty? Can a state come in and demand people? Can all of a sudden, can there be a law be passed that says everyone must be saved? Can you pass a law and make that happen? What is required for someone to get saved? Isn't it a personal faith? Can you dictate that to people? No. So if we believe in individual soul liberty, we don't want a government who dictates and says people will go to the Baptist church. We want freedom to present the gospel and not be hindered. We don't want the government arresting us because we preach the gospel. We just simply want freedom to do it. And freedom for them who receive Christ to follow Christ and to be a part of a Baptist church. And then I think of another one I jump out real fast, and that would be the saved. We have saved and baptized, but saved church membership. Most time when church and the state hook up together, usually what they say is everyone can be part of the church because it's a state-sanctioned church, whether or not you're saved. Now, what would happen to our church? I don't know how many. We'll say 200, okay? We'll just say 200. Let's say there's 200 people tonight, and we added 200 next Sunday, but none of them were saved. What would it do to the fellowship within our church? Would it be good or bad? Bad. Not because we hate unsaved people, but they don't have Christ in them. And the things of God are foolishness to them. And so, it's important that we separate then the church and the state. Now, we're going to get more into, but preacher, why do they say that the government can't be a part of it? Okay. Let me give you a couple backgrounds here. Some of these, one guy you'll know, probably one guy you may not know. The Baptists in colonial America, I'm thinking prior to the Revolutionary War, if we would go in a time machine and talk to these people, they were very keenly aware of how a united church and state brought persecution. The Baptists prior to the Revolutionary War were scared, fearful of what would happen in America based on what was already happening in Europe and England. They knew what happened when the state and the government were in bed together. It was great for whatever church the state liked, but the state is never like... I can tell you governments who were Lutheran, I can tell you governments who were Catholic, I can tell you governments who were Presbyterians, I can tell you governments that were... Calvinist, I know, but what was it? Reformed Church, there's a name for Swiss Reformed. There are governments who were in bed with these people. But can you think of a government in Europe or in England that was Baptist? By our nature, we don't want it. We've always been the red-headed stepchild that everyone has beaten, hated, and tormented. And so there was a fearfulness in colonial America. Now, English Baptists had endured much suffering through the years. Now, this guy here, Thomas, I guess it's... Helways. Now, you look, he lived a few years ago. And when you go back, 1556, 1616, it's hard to get exact information. Okay? But the best we can tell, he was one of the first English pastors in England. He wrote a book called The Working of Iniquity? Something like that. It dealt with, basically, the King of England could not tell them how to... In other words, King of England, you stay out of our religion. He wrote this book. He autographed a copy and sent it to King James I. King James was not impressed. By the way, we love our King James Bible, but King James himself wasn't a really good guy. But the only thing we commend him for is he set up the commission that gave us our King James Bible. He himself wasn't really a godly guy. So here's what he said. He said, "The king is a mortal man and not God. Therefore, no power over immortal souls of his subjects to make laws and ordinances for them and to set up spiritual lords over them." Now, how do you think the King of England responded? Not good. In fact, if you wonder, you see, 1556 to 1660, he didn't live long. You're right, he didn't. For his brave declaration of Baptist conviction, King James had him thrown in prison where he died. Now, they knew this. In colonial America, they knew what they came out of. We know this guy. Here's a famous guy, John Bunyan, author of Pilgrim's Progress. He wrote Pilgrim's Progress while he was in jail. Why he was in jail? Because he preached without the government's permission. He wouldn't take their license. Because you take their license, then they're telling you what to preach. He said, "No, I don't need your license. I don't need license. I got a command." And they said, "Well, we got a jail cell for you." Story is told where they would send his blind daughter in. "Hey, Dad, they said they're going to let you go. All you got to do is just take this license. You can come home to Mom and me." Broke his heart, but he wouldn't. "No, I'm not. I won't bend. I won't give in. I won't compromise." Now, he didn't die in prison, but he spent many years and a long time in jail. Now, that's the English background. Now, in our colonial days, prior to the U.S. Constitution, religious freedom was not universal in the colonies. In fact, even after the Revolutionary War, after the U.S. Constitution, it was not universal. Which is why we'll get to this statement by Thomas Jefferson. This is during the Pilgrim days. This is during the days when, of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin. In those days, Baptists were publicly flogged. You know what flogged means? Whipped. In prison and fined. Now, you know what they were doing? They weren't going to the approved churches. So we said, "No, we're going to believe what we believe by the Bible." So we all meet at Becker's house. We're not at the approved church. At the approved church, they're taking attendance. You're not there. They say, "Hey, Don Gasser, you weren't in church Sunday. Where were you? Because you had to be there. It was mandated." "Oh, you were at so-and-so's house?" And they round up all of those people in prison, fine you. Sometimes you'd lose everything you had, lose your whole livelihood. So they were beaten, they were ridiculed. People are very unsympathetic to their cause. Roger Williams, a famous guy, there's some different ideas about him, but he's considered to start the first Baptist church in America. And there's, again, when you talk about old history like that, there's some different ideas, but if he wasn't the first, he was one of the first. He was persecuted for his views on religious freedom. In 1636, he fled Massachusetts ahead of the Puritans because they were going to beat him some more. He went, found some Indian friends, and he founded then Rhode Island, the colony. And that was the first place. Didn't have just religious tolerance, but had religious freedom. There's a difference in the two. Some of the colonies tolerated. They didn't like you. They tolerated you. Rhode Island said, you have freedom to serve God any way your conscience dictates. First place. It was started by a Baptist. Now, let me give a little bit more into the history. What does the Constitution really say? That's a good question. What does the Constitution really say? When the Constitution was first written, we hold very dear the U.S. Constitution. I think it's a great document. So anything I say, I'm not slamming it. I think it's a great document. I think, I'm not saying the Lord wrote it, but I think the Lord used men to give us the Constitution and give us some of the amendments and has been a protector and a helper to our nation over the years. U.S. Constitution, wonderful document. The problem when it was written with no guarantee of any rights or freedoms. The original founding fathers thought, when the first income tax was passed, they were going to put a limit on it. 3%. No, the government cannot charge you more than 3% tax. They said, no. We would never even get that high. We'll never hit 3%. There's no reason to put a cap on it. Mm-hmm. Kind of wish it was 3%, don't you? Now, when they said this, they said, we don't need any guarantees in the Constitution. We're good people. We're not going to oppress. But what about the next generation and the next generation? And so, what does the Constitution really say? When the Constitution was first written, it contained no provision. This is important for religious freedom. The Baptists, some other groups, but the Baptists were really pushing this. They said, we will do everything we can to stop this. Okay, and I don't want to get in a lot of detail, but let me just give you a little bit of history so you understand. The U.S. Constitution was not our first laws. After the Revolutionary War, we had what was called the Articles of Confederation. Some good points, a lot of bad points. Some of the wise people, like Madison, he was probably one of the big ones, and a few others, Ben Franklin, they said, you know, this ain't going to work out well for us. So they got together to help it, to fix it. They quickly realized it's beyond help. And so they rewrote a whole new system of government, and that's what the U.S. Constitution is, whole new system of government. The problem was we had a system of government. Now, you got to go back and put yourself back 200 and some years and realize they're about to present to the people of the United States a whole new system of government. We just fought a war. We just have a brand new system of government, and you're trying to change it? It was hard pushing. The Baptists said, we will do everything that we can to fight against this and make sure it does not work. We will not pass it. And they had some control in some states. They had some good influence in some states, especially in the southern states. And so the Baptists worked very hard to bring ratification until there's a guarantee of religious freedom. They said, we are not going to submit to another government and turn around and have that government imprison us again. Now, you do what you want, but don't look for us our support. We're not going to build the gallows you're going to hang us with. That was their attitude. John Leland is a famous Baptist. Isaac Backus was one, John Leland. Isaac Backus was in New England. John Leland, I believe, was Virginia. Now, let me give you a quote. This is a quote from John Leland. This tells you the mindset. Never promote men who seek after a state-established religion. It is spiritual tyranny, the worst of despotism. It is turnpiking, I like the wording here, it is turnpiking the way to heaven by human law in order to establish ministerial gates to collect toll. It converts religion into a principle of state policy. That's a good statement. And the gospel into merchandise. Heaven forbids the bans of marriage between church and state. Their embraces, therefore, must be unlawful. Let me ask you, do you think he was for it or against it? He is definitely against anything that would put the state over the church or bring them together and unite them. He said, no, no. Don't favor us. Don't hinder us. Stay away from us. That's what we want. We want some guarantee to this. Now, In order to accommodate this, they passed 10 amendments called the Bill of Rights. The very first amendment, the very first statement of the very first amendment, guess what it guarantees? Here it is. Congress, this is the first change they made to the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. We won't favor, we won't hinder. That's what we always stood for. And we said, okay, we can support this. Now, it's interesting, all these other freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly, the freedom to petition the government, are all secondary to the freedom of religion. And that is true. You remove the freedom of religion, we're going to lose all these others. It's this freedom that is the cornerstone of all the other freedoms and then the other nine that follow. Now, here's what happened with the U.S. Constitution. Now, we're going somewhere, so don't leave me yet. Here's what happened with the First Amendment. It prevented, because there is a switch here at the end I want you to pay very close attention to. It prevented the federal government from establishing one religion or denomination. What it said is, now you got to listen carefully, because this part most people haven't grasped. It said that the federal government cannot go and say, in the USA, we are going to establish the Presbyterian Church as the church religion, as the state religion. They can't do that. At the same time, number two, it prevented the federal government from forbidding one religion or denomination. They can't say, oh, you guys over here, but this one group, you can't. They said, no, you can't do that either. Don't favor us, don't hinder us. That was always the motto. Don't favor us, don't hinder us. Just keep, you stay in your court, we stay in our court. I want you to notice number three. This is where the problem came in. This is the whole reason why Thomas Jefferson wrote that letter and it's been misunderstood. We tried to understand it in 2011. It was written in early 1800 based on number three. It did not prevent the state governments from establishing a state religion. The original Constitution was only governing the federal government. Not until the 14th Amendment, which in 1868, after the Civil War, did the federal government apply to everyone in the U.S. of A. Until then, the U.S. Constitution only prohibited the federal government or allowed the federal government to do certain things. That's why, in the Civil War, people fought because the state was more important than the federal government to them. Robert E. Lee said, they asked Robert E. Lee to head the Union forces. He said, I will unless my Virginia leaves the Union. Virginia left, Robert E. Lee left. His loyalty to the state was higher than because, and always in their mindset, that the state had supreme right over the federal government. And the U.S. Constitution only controlled the federal government. In other words, whatever it said in the federal Constitution did not dictate to the people of Ohio how they could run. So Ohio could say, everyone's got to be a Baptist. And according to the original intent of the U.S. Constitution, that was allowed. But you see, there's going to be a problem here. So because of slavery, because of the issue of state rights, slavery being the kind of the kindling of the battle, we fought the Civil War, and in 1868 they passed the 14th Amendment, basically said no state can take any rights from any citizens of the United States. They meant specifically the southern states can't keep the blacks away from having civil rights. That's what they specifically meant. The 14th Amendment has now been applied in many other, which really wasn't intended, but it has. Yes, sir?
I was just saying, it doesn't sound strange that the Baptists, especially say in the southern states, fought for all those freedoms, and yet that's where the slavery came in, and they oppressed people's rights to the southern states.
Yeah. Now, if you go back, the original Declaration of Independence dealt with slavery, and that was wiped out because they said that was too divisive. The problem with slavery in our history was there was always such a divisive issue that they felt like they could not, number one, fight a war against Britain if we tried to make that an issue. And they didn't think we could establish the U.S. Constitution. So they basically compromised. But you're right, it's funny that the Bible Belt was also the slavery belt. It is kind of ironic, isn't it? Okay, so number three is important to understand. If you understand that, you want to understand now this whole issue behind what Thomas Jefferson said, I hope. Okay, move on. Now, here is the misunderstood quote. Here's what he said in a letter, and I'm going to explain it to you. A wall of separation between church and state. Actually, we agree with that, but not the way they say it meant. What they say means today is that we cannot pray in public school. That's not what we mean. What we mean is, don't say only Baptists can pray, or don't say only Presbyterians can pray, or don't say only Anglicans pray. Just let anyone pray. That was our intent. Let anyone pray. Let anyone celebrate the Lord. Let anyone worship the Lord. Don't favor one group. Don't hinder one group. Allow it for everyone. Give us freedom. And we believe truth would rise to the top. The Lord would bless right, and the Lord would honor those who are living biblically. So he writes a letter, Thomas Jefferson. Anyone ever heard of this statement before, a wall of separation? Did you know, anyone know who he wrote this to? What group of people? Close. Baptist in Connecticut. He's writing to Baptists. Now listen, here's the funny thing. Agreeing with them on our position. They take his statement and made it into something else. He's agreeing with our position. They've made it into a different position. So let me explain to you why this is. Now, I don't expect the liberals to change everything tomorrow. It's not going to be like a news flash. And they're going to put on, hey, CNN said, hey, we realized Thomas Jefferson meant something different. But just so we understand, let me give you some background. We'll try to get through this next couple minutes. Let me say this honestly. Jefferson was not a Christian. Good man. Godly. How can he be godly, not Christian? Not godly. Moral man, sorry. Good man. Moral man, great patriot, great leader, owe a lot to him, not a Christian. Didn't believe in the miracles of God. Wrote his own Bible. Believed Jesus was a good man, but not the Son of God. Can you go to heaven that way? No. He was not a Christian. Now, here's the next thing. Understand this. Jefferson authored the Declaration of Independence. And that's going to be important. He did not author the Constitution. Madison did. Now, him and Madison were friends. And Jefferson played a part in it because Jefferson was actually in France at the time. Remember, there was already a system of government. Jefferson was a minister to France. And he begins corresponding back to America and telling them, giving them some ideas. But he was only kind of an outside consultant. Madison and some others did the authoring of the Constitution. Okay, and that's important to understand because all this is background to understand what Jefferson is going to say. Okay, two other things. Jefferson was a strong supporter of states' rights over federal rights. He did not believe that the U.S. Constitution should control the states. He believed it should only control the federal government, which was the original intent. Now, the fourth thing to understand is this. He's writing to a group of Baptists who held to the biblical view of church-state separation. Exactly what we're saying. Don't favor us, don't hinder us. Now, let's connect some dots. Did the federal government tell the state of Connecticut that it had to grant religious freedom to all of its people? No. The U.S. Constitution only said that the federal government could not itself go into Connecticut and prohibit freedom of religion. But the state government of Connecticut had to make its own decision. The state government of Connecticut was a congregational, I think. Congregational. Mainly congregational church. They allowed Baptists. They kind of said, okay, we'll tolerate you. The Baptists said, we're kind of concerned about this. We like what the federal government says, the Constitution, but we're not too happy what the state of Connecticut is saying. Here's what the state of Connecticut was saying. Okay, here's the basis of their letter. They write a letter. Thomas Jefferson gets elected as president. They write a letter to him. Oh, we're so glad you got elected. Now, here's our problem. And so he writes a letter back. Now, their letter tells us kind of why Thomas Jefferson said what he said. Okay, here's a problem. Let me give you a statement here. Again, this is just so that we understand why we believe this. Freedom of religion is a natural or inalienable right given by God. USA government does not give me the freedom of religion. God does. My freedoms come from God, not from government. The government's job is to secure those rights. In other words, don't let anyone try to oppress me. whether it's outside our country by military invasion or by within our country, is to protect the minority. If the majority of the people are in this congregationalist, should they have the right to oppress Baptists? No. What if Baptists outnumber the we have a right to go to congregational churches and shut them down? No. It's to secure these rights, not to give these rights. Okay? Natural or inalienable. That means from God. Remember that phrase. It's going to come up in just a second. The state of Connecticut said the freedom of religion was a favor. We are going to let you have freedom. The Baptist said, excuse me, are you God? I didn't think so. Who do you mean, letting me? I worship God whether they like it or not. Baptists always been that way. Hard to get along with people. Now, here's the problem. If the state gave the freedom, what else could they do? Freely given, freely taken away. And the Baptist said, no, you didn't give it to me, you can't take it from me. So Jefferson writes back in regards to the federal authority. That's all he can talk about. But the whole letter implies something. It implies how it could affect the states. Okay, we're almost done. We've just got a couple more things to say. I'm trying to give you the background so when you actually see what he says, you'll say, well, that makes sense. Notice what it says in Declaration of Independence. Who wrote this? Who's the main author? Jefferson. What did he say? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain... What's that next word? Jefferson believed that all rights came from who?
God.
Which is exactly what the Baptists believe. They have natural or inalienable or unalienable rights. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. Now, that's the mindset of Jefferson. Okay? Now, I want you... Now, here's the last thing we're going to look at. Here's what he actually said. It's a very brief letter. You can go online. You can find the Danbury letter written to Jefferson. You can find the context of it. It's a whole letter written out in text. And you can go find Jefferson's letter back to the Danbury, and you'll find the rough draft. Some things he crossed out. But if you go back to the rough draft, you kind of understand what he was saying, and he kind of reworked some things. Here's what he said. This is 90% of the letter. Believing with you. Now he's talking to these Danbury Baptists who are saying, wait a minute. Connecticut is saying they're favoring us. Does this mean they're going to try to take this away down the road? Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God. Government shouldn't favor it. Government shouldn't hinder it. That he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship. That the legislative powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people. And now he's talking about the U.S. Constitution. He says it really fancy. Which declare that their legislature should make no law respecting and establishing religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. First Amendment, right? Okay? Thus, building a wall of separation between church and state. The state cannot favor religion. The state cannot hinder religion. That's the context. If you go back in the history, you understand the context now. Adhering to this expression of the supreme will of the nation on behalf of the rights of conscience. Now notice what he says next. I shall see with sincere satisfaction what's that word there? Progress of those sentiments which tend to restore to man all his natural rights. What he's saying is this. I believe that as we go forward, all the other states will adopt the same thing. That there should be no hindrance and no favor by the government to any religion. Now, when he talked about a wall of separation, he did not mean kick baby Jesus out of the manger scene, don't let him be in front of the town hall because, woohoo, we don't want Jesus there because we have separation of church and state. What he said is the state should never, federal government, because we already have the U.S. Constitution, it will progress into the state governments, that's his hope and plan, that no government would come in and say, you can or you can't. They just back up and say, you have freedom. And that's what we've always stood for. Don't help us. Don't hinder us. Just leave us alone. If God blesses us, then we'll survive. We'll do well. If He doesn't, then we'll fail. But it's between us and God, not us and you. And so, that's the whole basis of separation of church and state, what we believe and how it's been twisted and means something different. So in other words, Well, anyways, we'll leave it at that. All right.